Okay, this is February 9th, 2010, and this is Mary McElroy Perry. I'm interviewing Mr. Ron Wallace from Louisville, Kentucky, and so welcome, Ron.
Thank you.
So if you want to share with us a little bit about where you grew up and some background information, your mother, father, siblings, etc.
I was born and raised in Louisville, Kentucky in 1947. I grew up in a suburb called Shively, Kentucky. Lived there absolutely all of my life. Was still living in Shively when I set off for Vietnam.
Okay, and what year was that?
That was in 1968.
Okay. So how old were you at the time?
I was 19. I graduated high school in 1965. Joined the National Guard in 1966.
Okay.
Came from a military family. My father was also a National Guardsman.
Okay.
A general officer in the National Guard.
Did he share with you any of the experiences that he had being a National Guard officer?
Every day. he was very, I guess you could say, gung-ho about the National Guard. He was initially in the rebuilding process of National Guard units around the Louisville area, starting right after the Korean War in the 50s. Quite proud of him. He went in the Army as a private, served every enlisted rank up to sergeant major.
Wow.
Was granted a commission and then served to the rank of colonel before he retired.
Well, I'm sure he told you a lot about those experiences.
Oh, absolutely.
So did that influence you in terms of making your decision?
Well, it had to. It had to. You know, I was raised under the flag, God, Mom, and Apple Pie. And it was just something that, just something we did.
Right.
Patriotism. I praise my father every day. He taught us patriotism, honesty, loyalty, and those things have stayed with me for a lifetime.
Yeah. So what were his and your mother's reactions when you told them you were enlisting?
He was fairly happy. I chose to join the National Guard.
Why was the National Guard rather than any of the other branches?
Well, at that time in the history of the Vietnam War, pretty much every 19-year-old guy knew he was going.
Yeah, because of the draft.
And I had decided that either way I was going.
It
was just something we did.
Right.
Your country calls, you do it.
Right.
I had an advantage in being able to join the National Guard, not to avoid anything, but I thought, well, if I have to go, let me go with guys I knew. Let me go with friends. Let me go with people I've worked with. One of the greatest causes of casualties were new people who didn't know what to do.
Right, and didn't know how to work together.
Right, right. So I had resolved myself to the fact I was going.
Right.
It was just a matter of how.
Yeah. Now, what kind of work were you doing prior to that?
I was working for a trailer manufacturing company as a design draftsman. Designing truck trailers.
Okay.
Most horrible job I've ever had in my life.
How long did you do that?
About 18 months.
Long enough, huh?
Yeah, long enough.
Yeah. So then what was the process when you decided to join the National Guard? And what'd you do then?
I joined the National Guard in 1966. I did my basic training at Fort Knox. And that was 6 months. I came back from Fort Knox after my basic training and just became a part of that unit. And that started out as weekend drills, 1 weekend a month.
Right. That's the way it's still pretty much processed now.
It is now. It increased. We kind of got the message. It increased to 2 weekends a month. Most of them, not at the National Guard armories, but we would move to Fort Knox and do strictly field combat operations, and I saw the handwriting on the wall. It's like, we're going. It's going to happen.
When you were doing it, you were really visualizing what was happening. What did you know about the war at the time that you, you know, enlisted and went into there? So what was coming back to you as people that were in the National Guard?
Well, here again, we watched it every night on television. Little did we know we were getting what the media wanted us to have and not the truth.
Still the truth now.
But we were pretty much aware of what was going on and how.
Yeah.
from the news media, and of course our training was strictly geared to Vietnam.
Yeah. So it was all jungle type warfare type.
Well, around Kentucky, we don't have any jungle.
Yeah, that's true.
But it was basic operations. This was an artillery unit. It was to be able to, we did a lot of, as I recall, what they called hip shoots. And that is, you pick your gun up, pick your whole outfit up, move them a half a mile, reset it, and shoot.
I've not heard of that term before.
They called them hip shoots. It's to be able to pick up and move quickly, reestablish, fire, pick up, move quickly to another spot.
Yeah.
Did quite a bit of that.
That was your training.
Right.
So when was the decision made to deploy you all to Vietnam?
You know, I'm confused about the dates. It was somewhere around June of 1968. I got the word. I was out at lunch. There were four other guys in the car, and I heard it on the radio.
Oh, okay. And didn't have cell phones then. So.
Didn't have cell phones. I heard it on the radio from WHAS News there in Louisville.
I'm familiar with them.
2nd Battalion 138th had been activated for service.
So what was your next steps after that?
Go back and quit my job.
Yeah.
Call my unit and said, if you need me, I'm ready now.
Yeah.
So actually, I was involved from June on.
Okay. So what were the next steps then in terms of getting to Vietnam?
Well, I joined the unit, went to work. Our jobs were to get the unit processed, get it packed, get them on rail cars, get all the trucks loaded up, everything ready to travel from here to Fort Hood, Texas. That was the next place we went.
Right.
We went for 4 months of very, very intensive tactical training.
Yeah.
I mean, every individual right down to this is your job and this is exactly how you do it.
Right.
And this is what will be expected of you. A lot of disbelief. I can still see guys sitting, this is a game, we're not going.
Really?
Yeah, no. This is something.
You took it seriously.
Oh, yeah, this is an experiment. They're not going to send us over there.
Yeah.
One thing that you may be interested in, I had a twin brother also. So my father, me and my twin brother were all on orders for Vietnam at the same time.
My. So your dad never, did your dad go to
the
Vietnam?
The Pentagon stepped in and said, we're not sending the whole family.
Oh.
So my
so they
dad,
intervened on your behalf.
Yeah. My dad was reassigned to Fort Knox as a liaison officer.
Okay.
And my brother and I shipped out to Fort Hood. Brother came up to me one day and said, you don't have to worry about Vietnam. You're going back to Fort Knox.
Really?
I signed a waiver paper. They after, I think he lost a family of seven or something in World War II.
Yeah.
And after that, it was a rule you didn't do it.
Yeah.
He said, I signed a waiver paper, so I'm the oldest by 16 minutes. He said, I'm going, and you're going back to Fort Knox.
Yeah.
And I said, no. Unacceptable.
Yeah.
So they had what they call a waiver office, and I made appointments to see them. I remember at 19 years old sitting out on the front steps of that waiver office thinking, if I don't do this and survive it, I will not be worth anything to myself or anybody else
the rest of your life.
Rest of my life. So I walked in, signed a paper. My brother and I had a terrible fight over
really?
It.
Really?
Oh, we had a fist fight over it.
Really? Had you ever fought before?
Little scraps, but nothing like this.
Major.
He said, you are not going to do this. I said, it's done. It is done.
Yeah.
I am not letting you go and me stay. I'd never live with myself if something happened to you. So I signed the papers and I went. So we trained at Fort Hood, and then in October of 1968, we got on a plane from Fort Hood, flew to... I think it was Andrews Air Force Base in California. And loaded a big transport aircraft, military transport aircraft.
C-130 or?
No. I can't remember. It was a jet, huge jet.
Yeah. What was that flight like? What were you thinking when you were going over in that airplane?
It was very quiet.
Uh-huh.
Not many people talked. We didn't have much to say.
Yeah. Everybody's processing their own thoughts about it all.
Yeah, everybody was kind of dealing with it their own way. Mm-hmm. And there were some still saying, one guy, remember, we are not going. They're going to land in Manila mm-hmm. and turn this plane around and send it back home. They just want to see, we are not going. And he was really disappointed when he flew over the lights of Manila.
So you didn't fly into Manila?
No, we flew over it. We landed at Wake Island in a terrible thunderstorm. In the middle of the night, we didn't see much of anything.
Yeah.
And from Wake Island on to Da Nang Air Base.
Yeah. How long were you in Wake Island, just overnight?
Or long enough to refuel.
Okay.
Worked there a couple hours. We didn't even, matter of fact, we didn't even dismount the plane.
Yeah.
We landed at Da Nang. Again, in a terrible storm.
What time of year was that? October?
Yeah. Okay. It was in a monsoon season.
Yeah.
And I remember getting off the plane, and they didn't have anywhere to put us. So it was night, very dark, and all you could see was lights going up a hillside, which I found out later was Monkey Mountain, which was just adjacent to Da Nang.
Okay.
They put us in a bombed-out building with a thatched roof in a pouring rain.
Oh, my heavens.
So that was our first introduction.
Was it hot there, or was it temperature-wise?
I really didn't notice. I knew I was wet.
Yeah.
And I knew I wasn't going to get dry until the sun came up.
Right.
And there were guys still saying, this isn't Vietnam. We're in Manila, and
really?
This is all staged, and they're going to turn us around and going to send us back home.
Yeah.
Those guys to this day are probably still very disappointed. But that was my first introduction to Vietnam.
Wow.
It was pouring rain in the middle of the night, and I was already miserable and hadn't been there an hour.
Yeah, how many people? Okay.
From Da Nang, when day broke, there was a convoy set out. We had no idea where we were going. Actually, we were going about 50 miles north to the city of Hue, a little place called Phu Bai, which wasn't exactly a place. It was a mud hole with some buildings thrown on top of it. And we ran in convoy through a lovely place called the Hai Van Pass. And it was a road that had just been cut out of the side of a mountain range right along the Vietnamese coast. We were terrified.
Was it still raining then?
Still raining, still nasty, muddy. Yeah. Nobody admitted they were afraid. But here we are in a convoy driving on an open road. We'd heard all these horror stories about ambushes.
And snipers.
We had gun support, gunship support. We had quad 50 caliber machine guns on flatbeds. We were well protected, but still afraid and vulnerable.
Yeah.
I was, you know, we're 19-year-old kids.
Is this a truck, that big truck that y'all were in? Or?
These were trucks. I guess there were 20 or 30 of them.
Wow.
And we just, it's like you see on the war movies. You pile in the back, throw your stuff in there, and go.
Yeah. So how many people from your unit actually went to Vietnam?
There were about 500.
Wow. That's a big group.
Well, there was two units in Louisville. The headquarters and service battery was in Louisville. We had a battery in Bardstown, one in Carrollton, Kentucky, and of course the ill-fated battery from Bardstown.
Okay.
And Elizabethtown was the other city.
Okay.
Yeah. So we got to Phu Bai to this Jale base camp, G-I-A-L-E. And it was adjacent to Camp Eagle. We found out later we were in support of the 101st Airborne Division. As artillery support and close infantry support. And from that time, it becomes kind of a blur. We just kind of did what we were told.
Yeah, not much sleep and not much rest.
Right. There were some buildings there. Well, they weren't exactly buildings. They were plywood forms with tin roofs on poles up off the ground. And the first week or two was just every day, getting things set up, getting areas established, improving the area, filling sandbags. I never want to see another sandbag as long as I live. When you weren't in the war, you were still in the war because you were filling sandbags.
That's hard, back-breaking labor.
It's just, it takes up time, keeps your mind occupied. But after, you know, being in the field all day or doing hard There's no easy job in war.
Yeah, it the guns all, are heavy and the uniform, your pack is heavy.
It was all hard work. I was assigned to an ammunition platoon, and we humped 155 ammo all day, 100 pounds of shell, and we did it all day long.
Yeah.
And then when we were done, we filled sandbags.
Yeah. Did they feed you well?
They fed us.
Okay.
A steamship round of beef is a steamship round of beef.
Yeah.
Only an Army cook can mess it up.
Yeah.
It all starts the same way.
Yeah.
We got, when we were in base camp, we got 3 good hot meals a day. Mm-hmm. I never got a piece of done chicken that I recall. Roast beef for about 5 years after I got home, I didn't want to see any kind of beef at all.
Yeah.
Unless it was a steak. I didn't want to see any roast beef and gravy. We called it mystery meat. It was something covered with gravy.
Yeah.
It was good. It was nourishing food.
Yeah.
But it wasn't home.
Yeah. Now, did you have any issues, people there, were they mostly cigarette smokers, or they drinking problems, or anything like that going on there at that time?
We had a couple. I became a cigarette smoker. And then I started quitting. I thought, why?
Yeah.
You know, I may not survive tomorrow. Why am I worried about what a cigarette's going to do to
me? Sure.
We had a couple of people. I wouldn't say it was rampant. But there were a couple people that just became terrible alcoholics. One guy from Carrollton I know died on the side of the road. He just drank himself to death. He became so dysfunctional that they didn't want to send him home, and they didn't want to cause any punishment. He was just, alcohol was the way he did it.
Where did you all get your alcohol?
It was available.
It
was available and inexpensive. And actually, for us, it was a piece of home. A bottle of Jim Beam. That's Barstown.
Yeah, that's Kentucky.
That's Barstown. That's 30 miles from home for me.
Right.
And, you know, scotch. I learned to drink scotch over there because at times it's all you could get.
Yeah.
And scotch became a real problem for me after I got back from Vietnam for about, I don't know, 20 years. I wasn't a drunk. I didn't go to meetings.
Yeah.
Probably should have. Wow. But I got to where I could drink scotch, just unscrew the cap and sit there with it and drink it. Later I learned it was called self-medicating.
Sure.
You can't fix it. You just try to drink it away and numb it.
Yeah.
A couple of the other guys got real involved in marijuana.
I was wondering about that because I've seen, you know, movies about that and stuff. Was that available there then easily or?
Readily.
Okay.
Readily. That was a matter of saying, yes, I'm going to do this or no, I'm not.
Yeah.
I did it once. I found no pleasure in it.
Yeah.
None.
Yeah.
I have one friend now that I serve with in Vietnam that still is, I don't think he's breathed a sober breath where he wasn't high on marijuana since we returned.
Wow.
He does it every day, all day.
Yeah.
I had another friend. I lost touch with him. He was really a stoner. He stayed fried all the time.
Yeah, even in Vietnam while they're out there with the guns and everything?
All the time.
Were they a danger doing that or for themselves or the others?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was a liability for the
Those guys
for
were
the
a
unit.
Liability. If they couldn't function when the time came,
if
you had somebody near you that couldn't function, that meant you had to take care of yourself, and a matter of loyalty, you had to take care of him too.
Yeah.
You had to make sure he made it.
Yeah.
Which means you had to do double work.
Right. So your group was pretty tight then.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everybody watched out for everybody. We knew everybody on a first-name basis.
Yeah.
You know, I had worked with these guys a couple of years before I ever shipped over.
Sure. So you'd already had that camaraderie there.
You had that bond.
Mm-hmm.
You had that bond.
Yeah. So how long were you in that location?
I was at Fubai for 4 months.
Okay.
Most people call it Way, but like I say, Fubai was a so-called suburb of the city of Way.
Okay.
We were there for 4 months in support of the 101st Airborne.
Okay.
And I went from an ammunition handler. The nights we would get mortar attacks, rockets, things like that.
Yeah.
And I haven't admitted this very often, but mm-hmm. I will admit it here. I was so terrified mm-hmm. of being asleep mm-hmm. and something happening, and I couldn't deal with it. Mm-hmm. That I would stay up most of the night, mm-hmm. and I started going to what they call fire direction control.
What's that?
It was a bunker under the ground. Mm. And I started going up there at night, mainly because I felt safe.
Okay.
I had some overhead cover, and I had something to do to keep me awake.
Yeah.
And I asked them, would they teach me? I wasn't even in that headquarters company. I was at a service battery.
Sure.
But I asked them, I'm interested, would you teach me?
Mm-hmm.
I became a pretty darn good radio operator.
Okay.
Well, eventually they transferred me to the fire direction control.
Hmm.
And I became the battalion message center operator.
Wow, that sounds like a big job.
It was. It had a lot of responsibility. I had one radio to the 101st Airborne. I had one radio to the helicopter traffic.
Mm-hmm.
I had three radios to each firing battery
mm-hmm.
who were out in other places.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to keep that traffic going, keep those radios working. Hmm. Make sure that the right traffic got past the right people. I had to keep a log of every radio call. I loved it.
Wow.
I loved it.
Kept you busy.
Kept me busy, kept my mind
occupied.
Off things. And remember, I got 4 feet of dirt on top of me.
Yeah, yeah. I felt a little comfort with that.
And unless a sapper got in there, we were pretty much safe.
Right.
Pretty
now,
much
were you
safe.
Still kind of connected with your guard unit?
That was my
guard
unit.
Okay, so that was part of it.
I was still with the guard unit.
Okay.
After 5 months, they did what they called an infusion program. Mm-hmm. They couldn't just take a 500-man chunk out mm-hmm. of Vietnam. They could accept us, but they couldn't send us home that way.
Yeah.
So what they did was, little by little, they broke the unit apart, mm-hmm. and we were all sent different places.
Right.
In my case, my brother and I, and luckily 4 or 5 of my very good friends,
mm-hmm.
were all sent to a place called Dong Ha.
Okay.
Dongha.
Okay.
That was between Quang Tri
mm-hmm.
and I'm trying to think of the most northern town. Anyway, it was in the Quang Tri province on the demilitarized zone.
Mm-hmm.
We could throw rocks at North Vietnam.
Mm.
I got up there and they didn't need anybody in fire direction control.
Hmm.
So I became a radio operator with a life expectancy of about 3.5 minutes in combat. Mm. I was very fortunate. I did not see a lot of one-on-one combat.
Mm-hmm.
My assignment was to set up radio relays mm-hmm. between units.
Yeah.
Radios then didn't have satellite capability.
What was their length? How long?
They would broadcast about 25 miles in a straight line.
Okay.
If there was a mountain involved, that's where they put me,
mm-hmm.
on the side of a mountain.
Mm.
I would take, one radio would receive, I would put it into another radio, and it would broadcast
it out,
over top of the hill further on out.
Yeah.
Which, in a way, was good duty.
Mm-hmm. Were you there by yourself when you did that?
Not always by myself, but with very few people. I recall one time, they woke me up.
Mm-hmm.
I had been busy all night. I hadn't had much sleep.
Yeah.
And the term was, get your John Wayne on. That was all your gear. We called mm-hmm. it John Wayne. Get your John Wayne on, take this envelope, and be at the helicopter pad in 10 minutes.
Whoa. Not much warning.
The only thing I was told was, don't open the envelope until you land.
Mm-hmm.
If you take fire, destroy it.
Wow.
And I landed on a scraped out patch of mud
mm-hmm.
on the side of a hill. And I asked, there was a second lieutenant Marine there, and about 10 Arvin,
mm-hmm.
Vietnamese Army guys,
mm-hmm.
and me.
Yeah.
And I said, sir, where am I? And he said, you see that patch of dirt down there in the valley? That's Khe Sanh.
Mm.
Well, now, about 8 months before, that place had taken a beating. It was under siege for over a month,
yeah.
and it became a very strategic. Lyndon Johnson said, we are not losing Khe Sanh.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of casualties,
mm.
a lot of hard fighting. That was during the Tet Offensive, and then for sometime about a month after that.
Yeah.
We had long since been evacuated.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, they have what they call BC scopes. They're very strong binoculars.
Mm-hmm.
He said, look in those binoculars. And mm-hmm. I looked and he said, those trucks are North Vietnamese.
Wow.
And
it's pretty close.
We actually took fire. It's where I was injured.
Hmm.
We took fire from 152 millimeter Chinese Communist howitzers.
Mm. So you were injured in that time?
Yes, I was.
Yeah.
A big source of my PTSD issues now
mm-hmm.
is having to deal with that.
Yeah.
We also took friendly fire from 155 millimeter howitzers.
Friendly fire from... Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't real friendly, but that's what they called it.
What was the relationship you had with the South Vietnamese during that time?
I didn't care much for them.
Yeah.
I didn't care much for them. The guy who washed your clothes in the daytime was the same guy that's going to try to kill you at night.
Yeah. I wondered about that.
You did not get close.
Yeah.
Or I didn't.
Right.
I didn't. I don't use the term you because mm-hmm. some of these guys thought they were the greatest people in the world.
Yeah.
They caught one fella in our base camp who came in every day, and I'm not sure what his job was. I think he washed dishes in the mm-hmm. mess hall or something. They stopped him at the gate. He had the full technical manual on a 155 millimeter howitzer.
Wow.
That's what we dealt with mm-hmm. every single day.
Yeah.
They, I've been a student of this for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
Historically, they said that during World War II in Korea,
mm-hmm.
a man who was in combat a year actually saw combat 52 days out of that year.
Mm.
In Vietnam, we saw over 200 days.
That's
it was
a
constant beating on your guard. Watch, you had to plan almost every step you took.
Yeah.
From this point to that point, and what will I do? It became an unconscious thing.
Yeah, it's just part of your everyday life.
Just part of your everyday life, and to this day, it still is.
Yeah.
It still is.
You think about it.
Take it by the step, plan everything.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of post-traumatic stress. Some of those things never go away. You just learn how to deal with them.
Sure.
So I had incidents like that. Spent a lot of time in the mountains
mm-hmm.
up around Camp J.J. Carroll.
Mm-hmm. Is that here in the United States, J.J. Carroll?
Or? No.
Okay.
No.
Oh,
that
there.
Was
there.
That was on the DMZ. You had Camp Carroll. I'm drawing a blank right now, mm-hmm. and I know them like the back of my hand.
Sure.
Because I hated every one of them.
Yeah.
And they said, you're going to Carroll. I'm like, oh, please don't make me do this.
Mm. Now, you're still a radio operator at the time?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was my last duty was
That's
radio
what you
operator.
Did. Yeah.
So my job wasn't to shoot.
Mm-hmm.
My job was to not be found
mm-hmm.
and keep that communication going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because there, other than the men involved, the necessary things for combat are you got to have beans, mm-hmm. bullets, and communication.
Yeah.
So you got to feed them, you got to keep them ammo, and you got to keep them talking.
Yeah. Those are the basics.
And my job was, under all costs, keep them talking.
Yeah. So how long were you there at Dong Ha?
The last 6-7 months.
Mm-hmm.
I was there from October 68 to October 69.
I'm
not doing the math in my head very well right now.
Right.
I'm a little nervous. These are things I haven't talked about.
Sure.
In 50 years.
You want to take a break and breathe and stretch? Or?
Yeah, if you don't mind.
Okay, sure. I can breathe. Okay.
All right.
So you were in Dong Nai for...
Dong Ha.
Uh-huh. Excuse me. Yeah, Dong Ha. And do you want to talk about how you were wounded there?
Actually, they had no name for it back then. Up until the Gulf War, it was just, they called it shell shock.
Okay.
It was actually a traumatic brain injury where the concussion, the shells hit so close that the concussion from those shells can do as much damage as the actual shrapnel.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember how many shells we took. These were NVA mm-hmm. artillery. But they were very, very close. As a matter of fact, about 11 people lost their lives in that operation.
Yeah.
my ears, my eyes, my nose, my gums, mm-hmm. every orifice in my head was bleeding.
Oh my.
The concussion had broken so many blood vessels. I didn't find out until about 8 years ago
mm-hmm.
that it had damaged, the concussion had gone in through my ears and damaged the balance nerves
mm-hmm.
that run from the ear to the spinal column.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been diagnosed as vestibular neuronitis.
Mm-hmm.
What that means is those balance nerves have been crystallized.
Yeah.
And I started suffering dizzy spells.
Yeah.
In early 1970.
Yeah.
4 or 5 times a day.
Yeah.
They said it was vertigo. They mm-hmm. tried, you know, they gave me all kinds of medication.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, what it was from this concussion injury.
Mm-hmm.
VA finally diagnosed it about 6 or 7 years ago.
What do they use to treat it?
There is no treatment. There is no cure.
Mm. But at least you know.
So I'm on a 60% disability because of it.
Okay.
But I live with it for a lifetime.
Sure.
As with the post-traumatic stress.
It's 100% disability, you know, as far as you're concerned.
Well, I made friends with it.
Yeah.
You know, this is how life is going to be.
Yeah.
And I've learned to deal with it. I've learned to cope with it. Mm-hmm. And I just go on.
Yeah.
Until I got older, and then it got unmanageable. I couldn't work.
Yeah.
So between that and a PTSD, I'm on a total disability
mm-hmm.
from the Veterans Administration.
Mm. Is that true of a lot of people that were with you at the time? Or did they have other barriers to get disability that they weren't diagnosed? Have you come across people in that
the
situation?
Majority of them are guys like me. You got to keep in mind, some of this stuff I'm telling you now, I've never talked about
mm-hmm.
since 1969.
Wow.
Nobody cared,
mm-hmm.
or they just weren't interested. They didn't want to hear it.
Yeah.
And after the Gulf War, serving in Vietnam became mm-hmm. fashionable. I'll quote you another statistics.
Mm-hmm.
Fully 1/3 of the people who say they were in Vietnam never were.
Well, that's part of this movie that this friend of mine talked
about. It's a popular thing to say, yeah. Oh, I was there.
Yeah.
Well, there's one thing an old vet can do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you asked me, where were you?
Mm-hmm.
Well,
you know it.
Fu Bai, Dong Ha, Quang Tri, if they got to mm-hmm. stop and think, red flag.
Mm-hmm.
You won't.
Yeah, yeah.
It's
they're a faker.
Simple.
Have you seen many of those?
Yes.
Charlatans?
Yes.
Yeah.
I used to deal with them in a violent way.
Mm-hmm.
Very angry, very violent, but that was part of my PTSD coming to the surface.
Sure.
Now I just shake my head and walk away.
Yeah. Not worth your time.
Not worth my time.
Yeah.
But through medication, one of the things we deal with, is this where you want to go?
Sure. This is fine.
One of the things as PTSD sufferers we deal with was that our whole lives became lives of anger.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really deep-seated pain and fear, but anger was easier.
Mm-hmm.
Anger doesn't hurt.
Right.
You don't cry with anger.
Yeah.
Men don't cry. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
But through some good psychiatric care, mm-hmm. some good medication,
mm-hmm.
we've all learned to deal with it. Those mm-hmm. who seek treatment, those who will admit it's the problem and seek treatment.
I understand there's a large homeless population of veterans who haven't gotten therapy and treatment.
Spend a lot of time with those people. It's part of my volunteer,
mm-hmm.
my volunteer work. I don't want anybody else to be as lost and as miserable as I was for all those years.
Yeah.
I don't fault anybody. It's not the government's fault. It's just war. It's just a piece of what happened.
Yeah. Yeah. But and, I mean, do you think that the Army is a little smarter now, or the military is a little smarter about how they, especially you think about Afghanistan and Iraq right now?
They had 150,000 guinea pigs out of Vietnam. Of course mm-hmm. they're smart.
Yeah.
They didn't know what to do with us. I even sought early on in mm-hmm. about 1971 or 72, I sought mm-hmm. psychiatric counseling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 2 marriages in 3 years had gone straight down the tube.
Sure.
I've had a total of 27 jobs
mm-hmm.
since 1969.
Yeah.
That's another indicator.
Sure.
You
know the statistics, you know.
Yeah. I didn't socialize well. I joined a lot of groups. Mm-hmm. I'm really not part of any of them because mm-hmm. you don't socialize. One of the things you learn real quick is you don't get close.
Right.
Because that guy may not be here tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah.
I used to tell my brother when he'd go out on missions, and he'd say it to me, and the guys would just say, "How can you do that?" I'd yell, "Hey, man, if you get killed out there, can I have your camera?"
Yeah.
That was a light way of saying, "Hey,
I love you.
I love you. Keep your butt down, your powder dry."
Yeah.
Because no one, I may never see him again.
Sure. And you both knew that.
And he the same way with me.
Mm-hmm.
"Hey, leave your money here."
Yeah.
And those were light ways, but we knew what we were doing.
Sure.
We knew what we were talking about.
Yeah.
Knew that gut feeling that I may never see him after he walks down that path.
Yeah. And the same with the rest of your fellows.
Well, yeah,
that you served with.
Yeah. But it's closer when you're brothers.
Sure. And twin brothers to boot.
Well, twin brothers and another guy named Phil that we grew up with.
Yeah.
I mean, from the time we were born, our mothers were dear friends. And,
yeah.
And we grew up through church and high school and all that. And Phil was another one. When he'd take off walking, it's like, "Man, don't let me go. It'll be easier for me to deal with if I just go."
Sure. You don't have to deal with the pain if you're dead.
Right. You don't have to deal with it.
Yeah.
But those things are more under control now. For those listening, I'm sitting here shaking. You're getting things from me that I haven't told anybody.
Well, thank you.
Is there anything else that I can?
Well, let's talk a little bit more if you want to finish up your story there. After you there as a radio operator, was that your last position there, your last deployment in Vietnam?
My last deployment in Vietnam, yeah, I stayed there. They're supposed to take you out of combat 30 days before you head home. I didn't have that luxury because I didn't have anybody to fill the hole. So I guess about a week before my ETS, that's your termination of service. Before my ETS from Vietnam, they put us all on a truck with overhead gunship support. And Lord, we had guns on trucks and helicopters flying over. They took us back to Hue. And then we staged out of Hue and flew back to the United States.
Okay.
A little story about our deprogramming. There wasn't any.
Did anybody have any?
Nobody.
In Vietnam?
Nobody.
Yeah.
I came
even
off.
Even when you came back?
I came off a fire base a week before I shipped home. Left out of Da Nang, went to Yokota Air Force Base in Japan, which still had mud on me. Ate the biggest hamburger with the most stuff on it I could find. Next stop was Seattle, Washington, where I ate another huge hamburger. Next stop was Stanford Field.
Wow.
And the next stop was White Castle.
I've eaten there before.
I wanted a White Castle. I dreamed about it. That's all I wanted.
Yeah, I like the White Castle.
But we got a 30-day furlough before what they call the mustering out.
Yeah.
So we got 30 days leave, which I enjoy just kind of hanging out.
Yeah.
What kind of
greeting did you have when you came back home?
Well, they when the plane landed, actually landed, there were a group there to meet us, like you see on the news now, these guard units coming.
Yeah.
My future wife was there, my family, her family, cousins, and it was all a big hoopla, rah-rah-rah, hug.
So you got a good hug home.
Got a good hug home,
yeah. That was good.
Yeah. And then come the next morning, it's like, what?
Yeah. What do I do next for the rest of my life?
You know, I don't have to be on guard.
Yeah.
Family just could not understand. They couldn't. I went back home with my parents because I had no place else to go, to be honest with you. I got in that hot shower. Now, I hadn't had a clean shower in a year.
Wow.
The only hot shower and good sit-down meal I had was at the Da Nang docks. We went down there to pick up ammunition. And Merchant Marines had their ships down there. And we had to stay out overnight in a pouring rain. And really didn't even have it. We were sleeping in the trucks and under. And the guys came off the ships and says, "Hey, you guys come on up here."
Oh, wow.
And they did our laundry. And they set us down to china plates and waited on us. And
how often did you
food.
Do that?
One time.
Oh, that just one time?
That was the only time.
Oh, my gosh.
We took hot showers with clear, clean water.
Yeah. but the rest of the time it's nothing.
Usually a wing tank from an airplane full of old nasty water.
Mm.
Sometimes it was purified, but the water over there, I never took a drink that I didn't shudder and spit. That's why I told you when I came in, it's snowing here today. I know adversity, and this isn't it.
Yeah.
I become really intolerant of people who say this water tastes funny.
Yeah. Yeah, not what you dealt with and all. Did you develop any parasites or any other health problems from drinking
water? Never
had
a problem with that. The water was purified now, but it was purified with iodine.
Yeah. And
if you've ever tasted iodine,
it's pretty nasty.
It is almost intolerable.
Yeah.
So the water was drinkable. Mm-hmm. It was pure, but it had that aftertaste of iodine.
Yeah.
That I carried scotch in my canteen.
Yeah.
I would put it. Shot of scotch in my canteen.
Just to cover the taste.
Cover the taste. Kool-Aid, we tried everything. Yeah. We'd write home and say, send us Kool-Aid.
Hmm. Did you get packages from home?
Got a few care packages. Mm-hmm. I love those little canned hams.
Oh.
And there was something they had back then called pizza spins.
Pizza spins?
They were a little cracker that tasted like pizza.
Really? Huh.
And sardines packed in mustard. And don't ask me why. But I wrote home and said, please send me sardines packed in mustard.
Something different than what you've been doing. Yeah. Did you write home very much? Or?
I wrote home, and that was just when they come out with little bitty reel-to-reel tape recorders.
Yeah.
And I did a lot of that on reel-to-reel tapes.
Yeah. Do you still have any of those from then?
No.
They didn't keep them for you?
I don't know if they kept them. Mm-hmm. I didn't keep any letters. I went for about 20 years there. I didn't want anything to remind me.
Sure. So you got rid of everything then?
All my decorations and all that were in a coffee can up in the closet.
Yeah.
Since that time and since I've gotten a treatment, you can tell I'm wearing a jacket that says Vietnam veteran with a whole lot of pride.
How long have you been doing that now?
I've had this jacket 2 years now.
Okay.
Giving back.
Yeah.
Giving back, giving my time to veterans.
Mm-hmm.
Who need help.
Right.
I've become very good on a computer and I can find
Facebook.
I Facebook a little bit, but most of mine is research.
Yeah.
If someone is trying to file a claim for an incident, you have to prove that that incident happened.
Yeah, and paperwork, didn't keep real good paperwork when they were open?
A lot of that. My injury, for example, wasn't really documented. It just said ear injury.
Yeah.
They came out some time ago with what they call the Vietnam Veterans Recovery Act.
Really?
What's
that about?
That means if you can find statements from two witnesses, it suffices as proof of the incident.
Okay.
That helped me greatly.
Yeah.
Greatly.
So how many of the group that you came over with did you come home with?
All but about... gosh, I don't know. Bargetown lost a lot.
Mm-hmm.
My very good friend, Bert Carr.
Mm-hmm.
Say a prayer for Bert Carr if you hear this.
I will do this.
Bert was the closest one to me who was killed.
Mm-hmm.
Both in the area that I was in, and Bert and I had gotten to be very, very good friends.
Yeah.
And poor Bert was just in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah.
And those are traumas that I live with every day.
Did you see him killed, or did you have to?
No. No, I was just told a story by someone who was there. And,
yeah.
I don't really want to talk about that part of it, if you don't mind.
Sure, that's fine.
But it was traumatic, to say the least.
Yeah. How about your brother?
Brother, not an ounce of problems.
Really?
He was never hurt. He was never injured.
Did you serve with him, or did he serve somewhere different?
No, we were in the same units. We didn't actually serve shoulder to shoulder.
Yeah.
My brother has serious PTSD issues.
Mm-hmm.
He, to this day, won't admit that they're a problem.
So he's in denial about
them. He's in denial, and he's very angry. He's,
Does he live in Louisville still?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you see each other often?
Yeah, quite often.
Does he know what you're doing in terms of this coming here today?
Yeah. Well, he doesn't know about this.
Yeah.
The only person who knows about this is my wife. Mm-hmm. This is something that I wanted to keep private.
Sure.
The world will know, but I want them to find out this way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't expect them to comprehend or even understand some of the things I've told you.
Yeah.
That's why most of us never talked about it. First of all, it wasn't popular.
Yeah. Do you think that's changing now as time has gone on?
Yeah. Oh, very much. Very much.
And with all the discussion about Afghanistan and Iraq right now.
I can wear this jacket and walk down the street, and people will actually get out of my way and shake my hand and say thank you.
Yeah.
And it's still very emotional.
Yeah.
Because nobody said thank you when we got home. They didn't want to know about it.
Yeah.
And if they found out that you were a Vietnam veteran, I actually had longtime friends just walk away and say, don't bother me.
Yeah.
You're crazy.
Yeah.
It was a painful, hurtful kind of thing.
Yeah. I wonder why people did that. Do you have any understanding?
I just don't know. It was the politics of the time. It was, you know, that was during all the protests, racial upheavals, all the other stuff that was going on in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't... you know, they used to say, what was it, draft beer, not people.
Mm-hmm.
It was just very, very unpopular. And up until the Desert Storm, when General Schwarzkopf just walked in there and cleaned house, then all of that became popular again.
Yeah.
We weren't even welcome in the American Legions and the BFWs.
Really?
Who are begging for us now because all the World War II guys are dying.
Yeah, they're all...
And my, this sounds bitter and angry, and yes, it is.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't good enough for you back then.
Yeah.
I'm not good enough for you now.
Yeah. So they were a little bit elitist about it.
You're not good enough for me now.
Yeah. So they were a bit of an elitist about how they approached things.
They just, we were all young, and they were, you know, they were old bulls sitting there trying to drink it all away.
Yeah. Still are, probably.
And, you know, you didn't fight no war. Boy, shut up.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't need that. I was walking 9 feet tall.
Yeah.
In my own mind.
Yeah.
Because no matter what my country thought of me,
mm-hmm.
no matter what my family thought,
I'm sure your father supported you.
Absolutely. Yeah. Except he's always been a little bit jealous.
Because you got to more combat duty than
I
he
went
did.
To combat and he didn't.
Hmm. Isn't that a strange thing to be jealous of?
And he was jealous of that, and I'm very sorry for him.
Mm-hmm.
He could have been a general. He could have been the adjutant general of the state of Kentucky.
Yeah.
But he had no combat experience.
Yeah. So the military kind of has its own little pecking order.
Yeah.
About things.
Yeah.
You know.
He had all the education, the war college. He had everything he needed.
Mm-hmm.
Except two things. One, politics weren't on his side, and he had no combat experience.
Yeah. So it kind of hampered his career not to have that.
Yeah.
Now, did the military help you any when you got out in terms of any kind of education?
Nope.
Nothing?
Nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing.
What about the Guard? Were you still a member of the Guard when you got
back home? I stayed in about 10 more years.
Did you?
Yeah. I was just an MP.
Mm-hmm.
Just because I had some kind of military connection. That was the, at that point in my life, that was the only thing I was ever good at.
Yeah.
So, I was a good soldier.
Yeah.
I knew it hand to mouth. I knew it top to bottom.
Mm-hmm.
I was good at that. So I didn't want to go back permanently because I didn't want to go back to Vietnam.
Sure.
But I got back in the Guard. And I stayed for a number of years until the Iraqi conflict came up and they started painting trucks brown.
Mm-hmm.
I had been there before.
Yeah, you'd seen
12 years earlier. I said, no.
Yeah.
I've had all my fun I can have.
Right. So you decided to get out at that point.
Yeah.
How many of the people that you served with stayed in the Guard?
Quite a few, actually. Mm-hmm. Actually, there were probably 20 here in Louisville that I know of.
Yeah.
That stayed in.
Yeah.
I remember one time I'd come back from Vietnam and I was looking for a job.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Kentucky State Employment Office.
Mm-hmm.
They had a veterans rehab guy up there.
Hmm.
And I'm, 20 years old.
Yeah.
Stone broke.
Yeah.
Just like these poor guys now. There's no jobs out there.
And they lose their jobs when they get deployed out there and there's no job to come back to because the economy
Actually, the law says... They have to be able to come back to the job they left.
Yeah.
But it doesn't always work that way.
Yeah.
So this veteran employment guy said, you in Vietnam, huh? Were you a good shot? I'm like, well, yeah. Well, I got a job for you. Pays $3 an hour shooting rats at a grain elevator. I just got up. I didn't even answer him. I just got up and walked out. I thought, is this what I have?
Yeah.
Is this what I have worked for?
Yeah.
Is this what I have come to? I was a good shot, so now I can shoot rats.
Mm.
And that was the first real sledgehammer in the head.
Yeah. Did you have many more after that?
Often.
Yeah.
Often.
So when did the tide start to turn? I know you said you talked about the incidents out there in front of the courthouse. In terms of maybe the military kind of realizing this and kind of changing the tide to try to help you some, or did you have to be really proactive on your own?
I had a total emotional collapse.
Mm-hmm.
I was watching, I love military shows and history, military mm-hmm. history and that kind of thing.
I
was born with it.
Sure.
You know, I was born with a flag and a pair of boots.
Mm-hmm.
I was watching Band of Brothers.
Mm-hmm. What year was that?
That was about, '98.
Mm-hmm. So 30 years or so.
No, more like 2002. Okay. 2002.
So like 32 years or so.
32
after.
Years.
Yeah.
Watching Band of Brothers, and there was an incident where they were in the Ardennes Forest,
mm-hmm.
and they were taking artillery fire.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw an explosion, and there was a boot.
Mm.
With a foot still in it. This may be unpleasant for you listening.
I'm a nurse practitioner, so gory things don't.
A boot with a foot still in it was mm-hmm. the absolute image of what had happened to me.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I had a complete emotional collapse.
Mm.
I remember screaming in my kitchen sink so the neighbors, I mean screaming.
Mm.
And I told my wife, I said, take me to VA.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to the VA hospital and told them my problem. Well, they have something out there called seventh floor.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody calls it the psych unit. They say seventh floor.
That's one out on Zorn Avenue?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I went to seventh floor and they had a long talk with me. I wasn't admitted, thank God.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you're admitted, they shoot you full of Thorazine and you walk around bumping into walls Zombie. For 15 days.
Yeah.
I didn't want that,
mm-hmm.
but they did medicate me,
mm-hmm.
sent me home. They put me in touch. I'm trying to remember the chronology of this mm-hmm. because it's kind of a blur
sure.
right now. They put me in touch with a psychologist, and I had long talks with that psychologist.
Hmm.
And she said, you need to be with a group.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at that time, I was still trying to work.
Yeah.
And they had a night group at a place called the Vet Center.
Where's that at?
It's on South 3rd Street.
Okay.
It only deals with Vietnam veterans.
Hmm.
Thank God for the Vet Center.
Where on South 3rd? What's it located near?
It's between Ormsby and...
Okay.
And Hill.
Okay.
On South 3rd.
Yeah.
Fellow who runs it is a former Vietnam veteran himself.
Mm.
He's been there 28 years.
Mm. What's his name?
Phil Gudeau.
Okay.
Gudeau.
Okay.
He did two tours in Vietnam.
Mm.
Fought his own demons, became educated, and is
mm-hmm.
now the director
mm.
of that. They have three excellent psychologists in there.
Good.
Trained to deal with us.
And they have regular groups.
Yeah, I have a regular group on, mm-hmm. on Monday night
mm-hmm.
made up of all fellows who were in the same area
mm-hmm.
that I was at the same time.
Yeah. Do they try? They plan for that, I expect.
Oh, I found one guy mm-hmm. in there. I'd never met him.
Mm-hmm.
And 40 years later, I find out he was on a hill where I was attacked.
Wow.
And he said, I was there.
Hmm.
I was there. I remember what happened. I remember where they came from. I remember what they did.
Yeah.
Even described the road coming up to it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you brought that back there. But
very
you know that got the connection.
It's, you know, like I said, you can talk to people and tell your story.
Mm-hmm.
They can't really comprehend what
yeah.
I'm saying.
Yeah. What would your life been without that now?
Oh. I'd be a mess.
Yeah.
I'd be a mess. Life is now, between counseling, medication, a very understanding wife.
Mm-hmm. How long have y'all been married?
10 years.
Yeah.
10 years. We dated for 10 years and then we married.
Yeah.
I want to be sure.
Yeah.
Every Vietnam veteran has 5 marriages.
Wow.
And at least 10 jobs.
Mm.
Because of stress and PTSD issues.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have any children?
I have one son.
Mm-hmm.
have one son.
How old is he now?
28.
Okay.
And he's very happy. He tried to join the military. Broke his arm working for UPS.
Oh, dear.
And it was serious. He has pins in it.
Ouch.
So he was medically rejected. He was really disappointed. We talked a long time about it.
Yeah.
And he was really disappointed that he couldn't do it. But I'm still proud of him for wanting to.
Yeah. Any grandchildren?
Two little boys.
Yeah.
Two of the neatest little boys.
They live in Louisville area?
Yeah.
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 So you get to visit with them?
Oh, often.
Yeah.
I have to tell you a story about the oldest one. The oldest one was 10 years old when this happened. And his class was studying Vietnam. And his mom called and said, Austin, that's my grandson, he wants to talk to you. Said he brought home a book about Vietnam and he wants to talk to you.
Yeah.
So I got in the car and drove out there. And he said, Peppo, he said, we're studying this and I got a whole lot of questions. I said, well, you just ask away. So he answered some questions. Some, you know, the innocence of children. Some were very blunt, which I didn't answer.
Yeah.
But anything he wanted to know, I told him about. I showed him pictures. I kept pictures and color slides. I have no pictures of death whatsoever. None.
But of Vietnam you have.
But of the countryside, the people, and the way they lived, and the way we lived, and the things we did. Yes.
Yeah.
I kept pictures of that. Some of the guys kept them, gory ones.
Yeah.
I don't need that.
To remind you of
that. I saw
that.
As much as I ever wanted to see.
Yeah.
But I had, he said, do you have any medals? And I said, yeah, I've got some. Next time you come over, I'll show them to you.
Yeah.
And they were up in an old rusty coffee can up in a closet. And I laid them out there. And he said, Papa, you're a hero.
Oh.
And I'm tearing up.
Yeah.
My grandson, who knew nothing of this, was the only person that ever said, you're a hero.
Wow.
None of us look at ourselves, and I've got some pretty stout decorations there.
Which ones do you got?
But I have a Army Commendation Medal, North Vietnamese Cross of Gallantry, Vietnamese Service Ribbon, Humanitarian Awards.
How do you get a Humanitarian Award in the war?
It really wasn't in the war.
No.
After the war, I did 6 months at Fort Chaffee, Arkansas, when Fidel Castro shipped all his misfits and ne'er-do-well over here. And they sent them all to Fort Chaffee, and we got to make sure they didn't eat each other to death.
Oh, wow.
So anyway, getting back to that, I laid all my medals out. So finally I said, I got to compose myself. Your grandkids can really rip your heartstrings out.
Sure, because they touch on those
tender
parts.
And I told him, honey, I said, everybody who was there was a hero. Everybody who survived it was a hero. But the real heroes are on a wall in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
Those are the heroes. Bertie Carr, and David Collins, and Ronnie Simpson.
Have you been up there?
Yeah.
Yeah. How many times have you been up there?
Just once.
Once. How long ago has that been?
I'm sorry.
How long ago has it been since you've
been? A couple years ago.
Okay.
A couple years ago.
Did you go by yourself or your wife go with you?
My wife went with me.
Yeah.
Very traumatic.
Yeah. It's to see that visually, it's a...
Yeah. That silence is traumatic right now just thinking about it.
Yeah.
Something that has to be done. That's the only closure.
Maybe.
To touch the names for me.
Yeah.
To touch...
Yeah.
To touch Bert Carr's name and say, okay, buddy, it's all right now. Forgive me, huh?
No, I've touched my dad's name. I know where you're coming from.
The emotion just comes sometimes.
Yeah. Have you been to the one here in Frankfort?
Yeah, I was there the day it opened.
I was there, too.
I was there in uniform. I was a National Guardsman on that day.
Really?
And I wept. I just sit down and wept.
Yeah. I think it's a stunning the way they arranged it, though. You know, I mean, it's really different than the one in Washington, D.C.
To know that the sun hits on each man.
On
I'm not sure if it's birthday
day,
or
the day that they were killed.
The day they were killed. And, and I looked up those names there, Bert and Davy and Ronnie. And some others. Didn't affect me like the wall did.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's
it was
a different
atmosphere
there. You know, I think it's a sundial, it's an open area, it's in familiar grounds.
Well, it's an emotional time for me. Yeah. The rest of my buddies who had served, every one of them just hard as a rock.
Really?
They just weren't going to
give in to anything.
It was avoidance. The emotion didn't come.
Yeah.
They were still in that it didn't happen phase. But I'm very thankful to the state of Kentucky for doing that.
Yeah.
Most appreciated from one man to the state.
Right.
Very much appreciated. So that's who I am and where I live and the world I live in.
Yeah. Is there any other memories that you have from Vietnam that you would feel important to share for yourself?
Yeah. Most Vietnam vets have a tough time with holidays, with Christmas, 4th of July, anything like that. I can't explain it except, you know, the 4th of July in Vietnam was every day. It wasn't a celebration. Christmas, you know, was a chance to get dry and get some stuff from the Red Cross and maybe get a package from home with some walnuts in it and, you know, some cookies and stuff like that. But for years, I avoided Christmas. Just avoided it.
Yeah.
Didn't want any part of it. And there was one Christmas, the Christmas that we were there. My birthday fell on Christmas Eve also.
Oh, your Christmas Eve babies?
Yeah.
Oh, bless
so
your mom.
Birthday in Vietnam on Christmas Eve is not... I remember I was in a mud hole.
Were you with your brother at that time?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was in a mud hole doing perimeter duty on Christmas Eve. We all decided, all of us in our unit, that we would eat sea rations for Christmas. And we took our food, loaded it on a truck, drove up through some mountains somewhere to an orphanage. And we fed those kids on Christmas Day our food.
Wow.
It was just a way of giving. It was a, I guess it's hard for an old man to say this, but there was a sweetness and a gentleness about those little kids. It was an escape from the horror for a couple of hours on a Christmas Day.
What made you all decide to do that, and how many people did that?
Most of the whole unit. They said they would have lunch there for people who chose not to participate. There weren't very many. There weren't very many. We just took everything the cooks had, the cranberry sauce and the turkey and whatever else they could mess up.
How'd the kids react?
Oh, they loved it.
Yeah.
They loved it. They were just, and we, I'm trying to think, we made little presents, although we didn't have anything, you know. You know, I took, walnuts. I had a walnut that I laid on the floor of my base camp house that I would lay there at night and the rats would roll that walnut around and we'd sit there and bet on which way that rat was going to roll that walnut. So I had some walnuts. I just put them in a little box and other guys took, you know, little, if they had little Christmas things from home, they little ornament or something and they wrapped them up as presents and, you know.
How many kids were there?
Oh, Lord, I couldn't tell you.
Really?
I couldn't tell you. I was just overwhelmed by the whole picture.
Yeah.
It was just maybe the one break in that whole year from all the death and destruction
and Christmas
and squalor, you know. And it's that's my most memorable.
So day to day, did you all play cards or?
Oh, we had jobs to do. Yeah, played cards. There's one thing about what they call enlisted men, that sergeant down. We'll find a place to make a club and drink a beer.
Okay.
So we had a little enlisted club when we were in base camp. Little enlisted club, and it was just a little house with some boards slapped up, set of beer on. But we sold beer, and then that money went into the company for the battery fund. And that fund was for special things. Every now and then they'd somebody get a line on some steaks. Now, you know they were stolen.
Yeah.
But they'd buy those stolen steaks for that company fund, drag them up there, and we'd cook them and eat them.
Yeah.
Just little things.
Yeah.
But we did that. We played cards. A lot of times, just the boredom. You clean your rifle.
Mm-hmm.
I sharpened a knife one time for 3 days.
Wow.
Just sitting, sharpened it.
Mm-hmm.
And rubbed it with jeweler's rouge and did things. I guess what guys in prison do.
Yeah.
And just anything to pass the time. War is 24 hours of boredom and about 3 minutes of panic.
And pain and
panic.
Fear, yeah.
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 So that's what we did.
Yeah. Did you shoot your weapon much in terms of your job?
Yeah.
Yeah, as a radio operator, I wasn't sure.
Shadows.
Yeah.
I shot at shadows.
Yeah.
A lot of times we go out just target practice.
Sure, just keep your skills up. Yeah, get your skills active.
I was very proficient with the M16. I was very proficient with an M203 grenade launcher. It was an M16 and a 40. It was an M16 on top and a 40-millimeter grenade launcher on the bottom.
Wow.
I got very good with both of them.
Pretty big kickback on those.
Not really.
Okay.
Not really.
Mm-hmm.
They were like, Katie Couric asked a Marine, said, what do you feel when you kill an insurgent? The guy said, recoil.
Yeah.
So, you know, he said, that's the age I feel recoil. Anything.
Yeah. It's a job.
It's a job.
Yeah.
It's a job. There were one or two times when I won't say I was even part of the fight.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't in the firefight shooting battle.
Right.
But I saw an opportunity to get in the fray, and I shot at shadows.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know
anything.
I don't know if anybody was involved or not.
Yeah.
I just, you know, I'm a 19-year-old kid. One time, I'm gonna get a lick in here.
Yeah. And, it's part of what you're there to do.
That's what I did.
Yeah.
That's what I did.
Yeah. Did you see very many people killed close to you? I mean that in your, you know.
More than I care to talk about.
Okay. Well, that's up to you.
11 in one engagement with those North Vietnamese howitzers.
Yeah. Was the paramedics good there? And did you have to do any medic duty at all? Or?
No. Once in a while, some little field stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like to talk about that.
Okay.
We were trained to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I took cellophane one time from a cigarette pack and put it on a sucking chest wound.
Mm.
They tell you don't let the wound close.
Sure.
And the guy was hitting the chest. I'm sure he survived.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they taught us the cellophane from a cigarette pack, lay it on the wound and hold it with your hand.
Sure.
And tie it very tightly with bandages,
right.
which is what I did. They put him on a helicopter. I assumed he did.
Don't know.
But we were all did a trach once with a ballpoint pen.
Wow.
Things that you just do. You're trained to do them. I taught first aid.
Did you?
Mm-hmm. And had been involved with it since Boy Scouts. And,
right.
And I just knew what to do, and I did it.
Yeah.
But God love those medics.
Mm.
Roger Coffey, if you ever hear this,
mm-hmm.
you should be a Medal of Honor hero.
Mm.
Roger Coffey was a medic with the unit out of Bardstown, that the National Guard unit that got hit so hard.
Yeah.
And the story I got on Roger was he was gravely wounded, seriously wounded.
Mm.
And they kept putting him on a helicopter to get him out of there, and he kept rolling off the other side and treating more wounded. Roger survived.
Mm.
I've kept in touch with him. Mm. Haven't talked to him in 10 or more years.
Yeah.
But he'll never walk right. He had some bad injuries.
Yeah. I had a friend, Danny and Diane Kaiser, and they had actually newly married, and they served as nurses in Vietnam together. I think it's kind of unusual to have couples over there.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. So what, did you all have much problems with, like, trench foot and those kind of issues? And
athlete's foot and jungle rot and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, they say change your socks every day. If you're out in a muddy monsoon for 10 days, you can't change your socks.
Yeah.
You can't even wash your feet.
Right.
Had problems with that. A couple of guys had problems with malaria.
Hmm.
They gave us pills that
quinine,
had some really unpleasant side effects.
Yeah.
one of the things they were designed to do was to flush the system.
Mm-hmm. Clean you out.
Right. And just about the time you got over that, they gave you another one.
Yeah.
But, you know, I took them. Mm-hmm. I didn't, and the guys that took them didn't have any problem.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones that did got malaria.
Do you have latrines there? Or?
If you could call it that.
Mm-hmm.
If you could call it that. It was half a 55-gallon bucket with a board over it.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah.
They were really not pleasant.
Yeah. Smell was pretty bad. I imagine
oh,
the heat.
Oh, God. You can't imagine.
Yeah.
You can't imagine. Grandma's house was perfume compared to these things.
Yeah.
But, yeah, we had facilities.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I'll never get out of my nose is the only way we had to dispose of human waste was to burn it.
Mm-hmm.
They'd put diesel fuel in it and burn it and stir it and
what
burn the liquid off of
be.
It, and it became a powder, and then it was able to be dumped and buried.
Yeah.
Because by that time it was just a benign powder.
Yeah.
One of the punishments that they had was to burn the refuse from those outhouses.
Yeah.
And I got punished a couple of times. I used to say I could write a training manual on how to burn this stuff.
So what kind of things did you all get punished for?
It could have been anything. I remember one night I was on what they called interior guard duty.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in the base camp. You just had to walk around and
mm-hmm.
make sure everything was okay. And in case we took incoming fire, you alert somebody. I'm walking along doing my little interior guard duty thing. And there was a couple of old Kentucky boys sitting there from Carrollton. One of them had a mandolin.
Mm.
One of them had a guitar.
Wow.
And four or five guys singing.
How do you keep those things tuned in the jungle?
They do it. They can do it.
Huh.
But these guys were very, we had a number of very proficient musicians. Mm-hmm. Had one guy take plywood and nail it together and made a working mandolin.
Oh, wow.
With screws and plywood, he made
it. Pretty amazing.
And he played it every day.
Hmm.
But it was a piece of home, and it was one of them wailing old country songs.
Yeah, bluegrass thing.
Well, I stopped to listen to him.
Mm-hmm.
And while I did, somebody robbed our supply tent.
Oops.
And the first sergeant caught him.
Mm.
And he had them
was
under
it
control.
Local people or?
They were in
Vietnamese,
our unit.
Vietnamese people?
They were in our unit.
Oh, your own people.
They were sitting in that.
Yeah.
Can I please?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
So you were in Vietnam from?
I was there from October 1968 to October 1969. That was the tail end of the Tet Offensive.
Right.
I was there 358 days, 12 hours, and 21 minutes.
Right.
Everybody kept it right to the second.
Yeah. So, in terms of your perspective from where you're looking at now, looking back on the war, you know, there's been a lot of books and opinions and commentaries on the war and what it meant to America. From your perspective, what's kind of your feeling about that time in America's history?
I think America did what it had to do.
Mm-hmm.
Douglas MacArthur was right.
Mm-hmm.
He should have wiped every bit of that out during the Korean War and taken care of it. Vietnam wouldn't have happened.
Right.
When you stop to consider that when we pull completely out of Vietnam and turn it over to the South Vietnamese, millions of people were slaughtered and killed. If for no other reason we needed to be there, just to keep that from happening.
Right.
And then over into Laos and Cambodia, and you see what a rat's nest it is over there now because we didn't finish the job.
Yeah.
Because Ted Kennedy and John Kerry should have stayed being politicians.
Right.
And the generals should have kept on being generals.
Yeah.
And it hasn't changed.
Yeah. So you don't see much difference in Iraq or Afghanistan now?
Nope. We got a bunch of panty waste up there now.
Yeah.
If you're going to fight it, then load up, go fight it, and get it over with.
Yeah.
These guys are playing games with the lives of young American men.
Yeah, and there'll be men that come out like you
and
dealing with these things, too, seeing what they've had to see.
Well, they're getting a little different care than we got.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I said, I got off a plane eating White Castle, tried to go back to work.
Yeah.
These fellas are getting the intensive deprogramming. See, mm-hmm. we had no deprogramming.
Yeah.
Say, okay, you're home. Mm-hmm. Good luck.
Yeah.
You don't wind down from that.
No.
All I knew how to do was war.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really, really good at it.
Yeah.
But I couldn't hold a job.
Yeah. What kind of jobs did you have over those years?
I hate to think. I worked as a buyer for an elevator company.
Mm-hmm.
I worked as a materials expediter for a heavy parts company.
Mm-hmm.
Worked in East Kentucky selling coal mining equipment.
Mm.
Trying to think. I went to work. The longest job I ever had was with an industrial chemical company. I was a sales rep.
Mm-hmm.
And I did really, really well with that for mm-hmm. about 10 or 12 years. I mm-hmm. really did well with it.
Yeah.
And as part of the PTSD, which I didn't realize, one day I froze up and couldn't get out of the car.
Mm.
I couldn't make a sales call.
Yeah.
I couldn't function.
Yeah.
So I stayed on literally till I got fired.
Yeah.
And then when I came out of that, mm-hmm. the whole world just crumbled in.
Right.
And I tried working a couple sales jobs,
mm-hmm.
Unsuccessful.
Yeah.
A friend of mine and I formed a little construction business
mm-hmm.
and started rehabbing substandard houses for HUD.
Mm-hmm.
And I had that for quite a few years, and that mm-hmm. was really good.
Yeah.
After that, I went to work for a courier service because it was literally all I could do.
Mm-hmm.
And I was on thin ice there.
Yeah.
And then after that, the Veterans Administration said, don't worry about it. You don't have to work anymore.
Yeah.
You can't. We'll take care of you.
Yeah. So what do you occupy your time with now? I know you volunteer and work with groups down there at the Veterans Center.
I do a lot of volunteer work with mm-hmm. With veterans. Mm-hmm. I do some volunteer work in other areas. Mm-hmm. I support... do volunteer for a children's cancer camp.
Hmm.
I do volunteer work for about anybody that asks me, from breast cancer to Louisville Deaf Oral School, mm-hmm. School for the Blind.
Yeah.
I have a DJ business. I play music.
Hmm.
And that's one thing that is it's a good hobby, but it's mm-hmm. a complete escape from everything.
So what kind of things do you DJ at?
Well, a big thing came about 20 years ago around here called bop.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like Jitterbug without the bobby socks.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Huh. And I got involved in that, and I play for a lot of bop club events.
Hmm, I never heard of that.
Do some playing down in, I played in Georgia, Carolina, mm-hmm. North Carolina, South Carolina.
Hmm.
Big contingency down through there.
Yeah.
I played in Cincinnati, Columbus, Pittsburgh, Chicago.
Wow.
And I do all that, but because I can draw...
As a DJ, yeah.
As a DJ, because I can draw those kind of people.
Yeah.
Then, you know, if breast cancer wants to have a benefit, great, mm-hmm. sign me up.
Sure.
I'll bring you some people.
Yeah.
So, and I do that, no money, I volunteer it.
Yeah. So all your radio equipment things that may have helped you in terms of handling all these.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. Hmm. I guess it's a way of keeping contact with something.
You don't do ham radios or anything like that.
No, I did CB radio for a while, but that was.
Yeah.
That was just, I didn't like that.
Yeah, technology's a lot different now.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But I still do computer a lot on a computer. I mm-hmm. talk to people all over the world.
Yeah.
Just love it. And, you know, you heard me sit here and spit statistics. That's because I read them every day.
Right.
Especially where Vietnam is concerned. I keep those.
Are there a lot of listservs and groups out there dealing with the Vietnam that are connected then?
Yeah.
People are connected out there?
Yeah. You can do a search for Vietnam veteran self-help.
Mm-hmm.
PTSD issues -Vietnam veterans. You can find out any information you want to know.
Is there a lot more support on state and national level than for PTSD and veterans?
Not much on state level.
Yeah.
Not much on state
level. I know there's a homeless shelter in Lexington. Is there one in Louisville, too, for veterans?
I don't know if there's one for veterans.
I know at Leestown and stuff wrote out in the VA center in Lexington, they have a homeless shelter there.
One thing they do have is the state has a veterans vocational rehab area.
Okay.
And, you know, it depends. If you can work, they retrain on job skills and things like that. If you can't, if you're in a situation like mine, I talked to a little girl named Caroline Johnson. Wonderful little girl, severely handicapped, but a heart as big as the back of a truck. She's just precious. And Caroline asked me what I wanted to do, and I said, I want a fishing boat. She said, well, we don't do that. But I said, I do like computers.
Yeah.
And what I wanted was a mobile computer, a laptop that I could carry with me, that I could, if I was working with a veteran and I needed to research something immediately, I could
or
just
get them connected to some services. Yeah.
Find out what they needed and that kind of thing. And the state supplied me with a laptop computer that almost runs itself.
Wow.
Well,
that's really
far
good.
More than I ever expected or asked for. That's one thing I will say about the VA and the state vocational rehab people. I never ask for anything that I receive from them.
Yeah.
I wanted help with my PTSD issues.
Yeah.
I wanted help with my balance issues.
Sure.
And I wanted help with vocational things. And I received 10 times what I ever expected or ever asked for.
Well, that's a blessing. I know there's a Governor's Council on Veterans Affairs. Are you associated with them at all?
I don't know anything about it.
Yeah.
I found out about this through an email.
Really?
And the minute I saw it, I was on the phone. I said, that's something I got to do.
Yeah.
I got to do. I got to admit, I had a little trouble telling this story. I didn't expect to encounter the emotions that I encountered.
Yeah.
But I love doing it.
So you would encourage other veterans to...
Absolutely.
Take advantage of this.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, it's a free service from the state of Kentucky, so, and in gratitude and honor for those people who are heroes.
People need to know what we did and what we learned and what we endured.
What you sacrificed.
That's right. That's right. I may have said this earlier. If one thing stayed with me all my life, there's no adversity. I've been through adversity.
Yeah.
I've been wet and cold and scared and hungry, and there's no adversity.
Yeah.
I tend to be quietly intolerant. This water's funny. Drink it. You don't know bad water.
Yeah.
Oh, you don't have a toilet? Yeah.
Yeah. You can survive a lot.
Go find a branch. Yeah. You don't know what it's like not to have it.
Yeah.
Why do I take a shower for 15 or 20 minutes? Because I appreciate it so much.
So it puts you in an area of gratitude for what we have here and how much we need to protect it?
Oh, people don't know. People don't know. They've never witnessed hunger.
Yeah.
They've never witnessed total abject poverty. They've never witnessed children being maimed because they went to school.
All people kinds massacred.
All kinds of little Vietnamese kids running around with a hand missing because the Viet Cong just chopped it off because they went to school.
Yeah.
1,000 people or more massacred outside the city of Hue during the Tet Offensive. Just put to their knees, hands wired behind their back, massacred and covered up.
Just because of who and what they were.
Teachers, educators, religious people.
Yeah.
Educated people.
They didn't want that.
Nope.
Yeah.
Kind of like now.
Yeah. I don't know if tyranny will ever be eradicated on this planet.
We live it every day, just they do it a different way, a little more quiet. You don't want me to go there.
Yeah. Okay. Well, is there anything else that you'd like to say about Vietnam or your experience then at this point?
I don't regret having had done it.
Mm-hmm.
If asked to do it, I would do it again the same exact way.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't change a thing.
Yeah.
Personally, I walk about 2 inches taller than anybody else on the street.
Mm-hmm.
And I wear a jacket with a Vietnam veteran patch on it proudly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Proudly. That was an honorable thing. Whether politically they thought it was or not, it was an honorable thing to do.
I'm honored you cared to share your story today.
I appreciate the opportunity to do it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.